Please welcome Shaklee's Chairman of Medical Affairs, Health Sciences, and Education, Dr. Jamie McManus.
Thanks very much, Jody, and hello, Shaklee family, and welcome to our February Health Sciences call. We're excited to introduce a new format for our calls that we're going to be testing here for the next few months and see how it goes. We basically, in chatting about this, amongst the Health Sciences team, we feel like we always give you a great deal of information on the latest science, the latest studies, and helping understand, all the various ingredients that we put in our Shaklee products. But we don't always spend time on these calls doing specific product training. And so what we're going to do is somewhat along the format of hotline, except that it's live and that there will be a Q&A at the end. So the first approximately one-third of the call will be this month as well as in the coming months will be about science and the science and research related to and kind of information or education about the specific area of health. Tonight that topic is heart health. And then the second part of the call will be talking about products that particularly help support that particular area we're talking about tonight that will be heart health. And then we'll continue to do our live Q&A at the end. Part one tonight and always will be archived immediately. Part two, sometimes we'll have to undergo some editing because we're talking about the products. They will be archived separately so that you can actually be able to access the science of heart health and education about heart health, as well as the products in the Shaklee lineup that help support heart health. So with that, let's get started. Tonight we're giving Pam a rest after her three webinars in January. I don't get a rest, though, and Les is joining us tonight, our VP of Health Sciences, Les Wong. So heart disease, obviously this is February and Heart Health Month, and we have a lot to talk about tonight. Just to remind everybody, the heart is somewhat an important organ. You actually can't live without your heart. And despite the fact that there are heartless people out there, somehow they just keep on living. I don't know what that's about. But anyway, we're going to talk. So basically, your heart is the major major organ. I have to have a little levity here to start the call. Your heart is comprised of four chambers. You have the right side of your heart and the left side of your heart. You have valves between those chambers. And coronary artery disease is the most common type of heart disease. That is essentially the result of atherosclerosis, which is this buildup of cholesterol plaque and inflammation in the arterial walls that essentially closes off the blood flow to critical organs, primarily your heart and your brain. If the obstruction is in coronary arteries, then it is a heart attack that one has. If it is in the cerebral vasculature in your brain, in your head area, then that can be essentially a stroke. So heart disease and stroke are two of the most significant causes of death in America, and in fact, heart disease continues to be the number one cause of death. Go through a few statistics in a minute. Stroke is the number three cause of death by most of the statistical organizations that you see out there, the statistical data out there. And then there are other conditions which we're not going to really focus too much on that are oftentimes related to, there's other types of heart disease related to viral infections, related to autoimmune disorders, related to heart failure, which can be related to a lot of different different conditions. So we're going to focus primarily on coronary artery disease or coronary heart disease and stroke, as those are really and tonight primarily we're going to be talking about coronary artery disease since this is Heart Health Month. But just to know that all of the risk factors for heart disease also apply for stroke. And so sometimes it's somewhat of a genetic tendency. So you may look at your family history as to what tends to happen more in your family, heart disease or stroke, or possibly neither. Your family history may be rife with cancer or diabetes or other heart health or other disease risk factors. So now, speaking of risk factors, let's talk about some of the significant issues out here related to heart disease. Number one, One of the reasons we're talking about this and another reason why there is a heart health month is because this is such a prevalent disorder. It is the number one cause of death for both men and women. It wasn't always the number one cause of death for women, but over the past 15 to 20 years, that has continued to increase. The prevalence of heart disease has continued to increase in women for a number of reasons. Obesity is part of that, and as we go through all the risk factors, the fact that more and more women are overweight, more and more women are dealing with stress and dealing with oftentimes juggling careers, and the home situation has, you know, are the, some of the theories as to why we see more heart disease in women, because we are seeing even premenopausal heart disease increase significantly amongst women. More women started smoking over the past 20 to 30 years as well, another one of the risk factors. Anyway, the bottom line is that heart disease is the leading cause of death for both men and women. It is the cause of about 26% of all deaths. In other words, one out of every four deaths in America are due to heart disease. Another kind of staggering statistic is that not only do 75 million Americans have existing diagnosed heart disease, but another 60 million have something called metabolic syndrome, which puts you at very increased risk of developing heart disease. So these are people that have high blood pressure, elevated lipids, obesity, oftentimes increased C-reactive protein, and pre-diabetes or even diabetes can be rolled into that category of metabolic syndrome. So we also know that despite the fact that the death rate from heart disease continues to decline, in other words, we continue to get better treatments. We have better things that address the actual heart attack occurring, such as automatic defibrillators that are available on airplanes and in shopping malls and things like that. We are doing a little bit better job of keeping people alive once they have a heart attack. We're not really decreasing the prevalence or the likelihood of having heart disease. And just to throw out a little bit of a dismal statistic, 47% of all heart attack deaths are what we call sudden death heart attacks, which means that the person dies outside of a hospital, so never gets to the possibility of treatment other than those automatic defibrillators that may keep someone alive long enough if they're away from a hospital when they have their actual heart attack, which, of course, leads us to what we really focus on here in Shackley, and that is prevention. We're trying to help you understand what the risk factors are for the development of heart disease and what you can do to address those. Deaths do vary. Heart disease and heart disease varies by ethnicity. We do see higher likelihood or higher prevalence of heart disease in African Americans, in American Indians, and in Hispanics. But the death rates are actually not that different. So that there's apparently a similarity in treatment levels for irregardless of your ethnicity. We clearly show that reducing risk factors, I mean, that is one of the things that has been most well proven in the past 15 years, is that reduction of risk factors, in particular reduction of blood pressure and cholesterol, do have significant effects and ramifications on the prevalence of heart disease and actually the risk of dying from heart disease. So what are the risk factors? Let's just go through them, and then it'll be relatively clear what we're going to focus on, because some of them we can't really do much about, and some of them we certainly can. So the top and what are considered the more major risk factors for heart disease include your family history, which you can't do anything about. We haven't yet learned a way to choose a different family once you've been born. Two is age. We can't do anything about that either. And as you get older, you do have an increased risk of heart disease. Smoking and obesity are the other two major risk factors. Obviously, people can quit smoking. There are more and more smoking cessation tools out there, and so that is a commitment, and yet still almost one quarter of our American population still does smoke. Obesity, clearly we have some ways to address that as well, and that is something that is theoretically in people's control. Diabetes is another major risk factor, again, oftentimes related to lifestyle lifestyle, diet, and weight, also issues that can be addressed. And then the kind of subset of risk factors include your sedentary lifestyle, meaning physical inactivity is a risk factor. So the less active you are, the more likely you are to have heart disease, and which is in part related to what all of these risk factors we just talked about lead to, and that includes elevated lipids and elevated blood pressure, which are the other two significant risk factors for heart disease. Inflammation is another risk factor for heart disease, and actually the American Heart Association does associate elevations in C-reactive protein with an increased risk of heart disease, and we will go through a little bit of that as well. So reducing the risk factors, I wanted to throw out a couple of other kind of interesting facts before we start addressing all these risk factors. That's what we're going to do now, is go through what we can do to address all these various risk factors related to heart disease. There's a study that was just published here a few months ago in the Annals of Family Medicine that looked at the prevalence of coronary heart disease risk factors and the screening for high cholesterol among young adults. So adults between the ages of 20 and 45. And what was interesting about this was basically the overall statistics, meaning about 59% of young adults have coronary heart disease risk factors. So 60% of our young adults between the ages of 20 and 45 already have at least one risk factor. And approximately 26% of this young adult category has two or more risk factors. And that 65% of this group had elevated LDL cholesterol as the major risk factor. So it's certainly of concern that we see these statistics occurring, and this prevalence of heart health risk factors or heart disease risk factors in younger populations. Of course, we've known about this since the Vietnam War, when some of the autopsies done on men who were killed during the Vietnam War and were as young as 19 and 20 years old already showed signs of atherosclerosis. That was somewhat of a wake-up call and really started, you know, the search for what was it in our lifestyle that was causing this, since we didn't, you know, really see people having heart disease at such young ages, 50 and 100 years ago, or actually at that time, 50 and 100 years ago, which is now 75 and 125 years ago. Another study just published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine also looked at the relevance of body fatness in young children relative to their left ventricular mass, so their the size of their heart related to body fat, and this already in young children showed a correlation between obesity in young children and not only their weight but their percentage of body fat was directly associated with their left ventricular size. Left ventricular is the left side of the heart, which is what you see tending to thicken and enlarge as a result of high blood pressure and as a result of being overweight. And then the final one is just kind of an interesting one to throw out before we go to addressing the risk factors, and that was a study published in the American Journal of Epidemiology in 2009, and the title of the study, Life Years Gained Among U.S. Adults from Modern Treatments and Changes in Prevalence of Six Coronary Heart Disease Risk Factors Between 1980 and 2000. So basically what this study did was compare the addition of life years or added life expectancy as a result of adjusting or improving lifestyle factors, specifically better, more active lifestyle, less sedentary lifestyle, to weight loss and three, treatment of high blood pressure and cholesterol, versus specific coronary artery disease treatments, meaning heart surgeries, angioplasties, and coronary artery bypass surgeries, et cetera. And the results of this study were clear that actually there was almost twice the number of life expectancy years added by virtue of the lifestyle factors as opposed to the treatment, which again, you know, kind of speaks to our message of helping people understand what they need to do to take control of their health and to be able to potentially change the course of their future life by knowing that they can make changes in their life that will result in their potentially not developing diseases down the road and dying later, hopefully, of something else. since unfortunately we all seem to have to do that at some point in time. So let's go on to now addressing these various factors that are related to the development of heart disease. I'm going to turn it over to Les to talk about lifestyle as well as lipids as major risk factors.
Thank you, Dr. McManus. And the first place I will start is talking about a healthy diet. And surprise, surprise, we're going to be talking about things that we have talked about over the years. We're not talking about rocket science diets here. We're talking about good, sound, healthy choices, the kinds of dietary choices that we've been promoting for many, many, many years here. Specifically, the American Heart Association recommended diet and eating plan is targeted towards reducing three specific risk factors, three that Dr. Jamie mentioned, and that they are elevated blood cholesterol levels, elevated blood pressure, and being overweight or excess body weight. So the recommendations, again, they're not going to be much different than what you've heard us say before. Eat a variety of vegetables and fruits equaling 5 to 9 servings per day. Eat a variety of grains equal to 6 servings per day. And, of course, the amount of servings depends on your activity level, your body size, your genetics. And so just take these as guidelines. Here's a very important one. Eat fish at least twice per week, preferably fatty fish like salmon or tuna. Choose reduced-fat dairy products. Eat legumes, skinless poultry, and lean cuts of meats. Select fats with low content of saturated fat, such as liquid and tub, margarine, canola, corn, safflower, and olive oils. Balance calories each day with calories burned. And I'm not going to go into a long sermon on that one, but try to exercise enough to balance out the amount of calories that you're taking in on a daily basis. Pretty simple, and that will keep you at or help you achieve and maintain a healthy weight. Be physically active. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Limit high-calorie, empty-calorie, low-nutrition foods like soft drinks, candy, processed foods that are high in fat content. A lot of these foods that we've been weaned on by television commercials and that our kids have been weaned on and have come to love, unfortunately, in this day and age. Limit foods high in saturated fat, trans fat, and cholesterol. Maintain sodium intake or salt intake at below 2,400 milligrams or 1 1/4 tablespoons per day. The bottom line is you may not know how much that is, but we all probably eat a little bit too much and could afford to cut back. And the last one is limit alcoholic beverages to no more than 1 drink per day for women and no more than 2 drinks for men. And now that we're past the Super Bowl, we might be able to achieve that very lofty goal. In terms of exercise, one of my favorite topics has always been one of my favorite topics here at Shackley and personally. The American Heart Association just actually issued new guidelines in mid-January. They sort of coincided with the new dietary guidelines for Americans, actually dated 2010, but issued in 2011. We'll be talking about those guidelines and what you should embrace out of those guidelines in next month's conference call, and that's going to be National Nutrition Month, and I think the dietary guidelines will be a very appropriate topic to address at that particular time. But the American Heart Association exercise guidelines are now suggesting at least 30 minutes per day or 150 minutes per week of moderate exercise or 75 minutes per week of vigorous exercise. I think most of us should shoot for moderate exercise, 30 minutes per day. That makes a lot of sense, and most of us can do it. I know that in some parts of the country, I remember speaking to a colleague in the Chicago area who received about 20 inches of snow one day last week, so she was unable to get out and exercise. So she will be excused for that one day, but for the rest of us, we need to really get out there.
In California, we have no excuse.
And walk and swim and do gardening and find some way to stay active because that's one of the best ways to support optimal health. If you can't do the exercise all in one fell swoop at 30 or 45 minutes at a time, remember that you can break your exercise down into 2 or 3 segments of 10 or 15 minutes per day. Whatever you can work in, a walk, a break away from the office, not only will it help you get fitter, but mentally it will probably be beneficial for you as well. Again, walking is something that most all of us can do. I fondly remember my visit to Minneapolis last January when the temperature achieved a very warm minus 13 degrees.
That was the high, right?
That wasn't the high. That was the low. But I do recall some of my colleagues heading over to the Great Mall of Minneapolis, or the big mall there,
mm-hmm.
Because there's a walking loop, I believe, that's 1.3 miles in length. So there are ways to
find them all.
It's a good reason to shop, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, exercise, exercise, exercise. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is addressing lipids. And there are guidelines for cholesterol, and there are guidelines for triglycerides, some of these lipids that are very increase your risk for heart disease. And right now I'm going to talk about the therapeutic lifestyle changes from the National Cholesterol Education Program. Their diet, again, is focused on reducing cholesterol and LDL cholesterol specifically. Their guidelines are, number one, decrease saturated fat intake in the diet, limit to less than 7% of total calories. How do you do that? You do it by doing the same thing that the American Heart Association diet guides you on, choosing lean cuts of meat, low-fat, non-fat dairy products, limiting intake of saturated fats and oils, palm kernel and coconut oil, limiting intake of fried and snack foods, and just limiting fat intake in general. The next thing, lower the cholesterol intake in the diet. Eat no more than 200 milligrams per day, which means limiting your intake of egg yolks, choosing low-fat or non-fat dairy products, and again, choosing lean cuts of meat when you choose meat. The next thing, this will always be an important part of any program that we come out with, and that is to achieve and maintain an optimal weight and exercise, and lose 10 pounds if you're overweight. Manage your weight, manage portion sizes, and commit to exercise several days each week. Two critical ones that you can do by adding things to your diet. Number one, increasing dietary fiber intake, especially soluble fiber intake. And that means trying to get your intake up to 25 grams or more per day. For most of us, that means probably adding 10 to 15 grams of dietary fiber. You can find these in whole grain and oat-based breads, crackers, and cereal products, eating fresh vegetable, eating brown rice, barley, beans, lentils, and legumes. And the last thing that is part of the therapeutic lifestyle changes is to add plant sterols and stanols to your diet. Plant sterols and stanols are waxy compounds found in very small amounts in fruits, vegetables, seeds, and grains, and these can be added to your diet very simply to boost your sterol intake, because that's been shown to lower cholesterol, and specifically LDL cholesterol, which again reduces your risk for heart disease. One other compound to take notice of is triglycerides. Triglycerides are another fatty component in the blood that increases your risk for heart disease. The National Cholesterol Education Program guidelines for triglycerides basically is that you want to have triglyceride levels less than 150 milligrams per deciliter. We actually did a study, we did a landmark study in 2007, which basically showed when we compared a dietary supplement using population to a non-supplementing, sort of more average American population, we found that the average American population had a triglyceride level of just about 150. They were borderline high, whereas the supplementing population was much more favorable, down closer to the 120 milligram per DL level. Now I'm going to turn it back to Dr. Jamie to take a stab at some of the other risk factors and things we can do to address these risk factors for heart disease.
Thanks, Les. So I'm going to talk about hypertension or elevated blood pressure and inflammation. And then we're going to go through some supplements that we think have some value in helping to either reduce your risk or deal with existing risk factors that you may have related to the development of heart disease. So high blood pressure, also known as hypertension, is a very serious condition, certainly is a risk factor for coronary heart disease. It's also a risk factor for heart failure, for stroke, for kidney disease, including kidney failure, and to many other health problems. Blood pressure, just to define that, is actually the force of blood pushing against the walls of your arteries as the heart pumps out the blood. As if your arteries get more stiff, which can happen with over time, but also happens, that's part of the development of high blood pressure, is stiffening of the arteries, leading to an increase in pressure and therefore stress upon the heart and other organs, including the kidneys, in order to deal with this, to compensate essentially for this elevation in blood pressure. Approximately one in three adult Americans has high blood pressure at this point, so this is an extremely common disorder. It has no symptoms, and that is the one of the biggest risk factors, somewhat like elevated cholesterol. You don't know by how you feel that you have high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol until your blood pressure becomes very high, indeed high enough to cause an acute stroke when your systolic blood pressure rises a very high, over 200 millimeters per deciliter pressure. And while we're speaking of those systolic and diastolic blood pressures, systolic is the top number, that's the higher number, and diastolic is the lower number. Systolic blood pressure is the pressure when the heart actually beats, and the diastolic blood pressure is the blood pressure between the beats. So that's why the higher number and then the lower number. We like to see your blood pressure being lower than 120 over 80, 120 systolic and 80 diastolic. When your blood pressure starts to rise above that, you may be in a category of pre-hypertension. And depending on whether you have other risk factors for the development of heart disease, your physician may actually want to treat you with an antihypertensive drug, even in this pre-hypertension phase. But certainly when you reach this, what was called stage one hypertension, when your systolic blood pressure reaches 140 or higher, and your diastolic is consistently at 90 or higher. So if you're in 140 to approximately 160 on the systolic versus over 90 to 100 or 90 to 99 technically, then you are stage one hypertension. If you go above that, it's stage two, and just that more severe and more likely to result in health issues. Again, leading to heart attack and stroke most significantly, but also to many other diseases, including kidney disease. One of the more common reasons for kidney disease, and in particular in African Americans, hypertension is a huge risk factor for kidney disease, even more so than coronary artery disease. So the causes of high blood pressure are really not completely known. We certainly have associated risk factors, things that we see commonly in people who have hypertension. And these are some of these include smoking. We know that if people quit smoking, their blood pressure usually drops. That's because of nicotine and other compounds in the in cigarettes having that direct effect on your arteries. We know that being overweight to obese is another risk factor. Also being inactive. We know that even though your blood pressure goes up slightly with exercise, the overall effect of regular exercise is to have a lower blood pressure, and that's just a toning effect on your arteries, on your heart, on your lungs, on your vascular system, et cetera. Too much salt or sodium in the diet is also a risk factor. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Excessive alcohol consumption is also a risk factor, and Les already mentioned this, but this is another area where women should stay at one drink or less per day of alcohol, assuming you drink, and men two drinks a day, or that's per day, not per hour, or less. Other things, other risk factors for hypertension we can't always control. One is family history and chronic kidney disease, and adrenal or thyroid disorders can lead to blood pressure problems. Again, appropriate treatment of those may then eliminate your hypertension as a risk factor. So what can you do if you have high blood pressure in order to lower your blood pressure? Les has really already gone through most of these. All the dietary things related to heart disease are going to do all the good things of lowering blood pressure, cholesterol, et cetera. But a couple of other things that I wanted to mention was stress management. There's a couple of recent studies that suggest that some of the ancient relaxation methods that include controlled breathing and gentle physical exercise activity such as yoga and tai chi are quite beneficial for people with high blood pressure. These are actually small studies, but certainly the results were so significant that the recommendation is for larger scale trials to confirm these. This is, you know, somewhat of a no-brainer from my perspective because these are activities that can't do anything but good things for you to help relax you. We know that chronic stress is a risk factor for all sorts of health problems, including heart disease and high blood pressure. So the fact that we, you know, have research showing that just deep breathing for 15 minutes a day for 8 weeks, and also undertaking for 8 weeks tai chi or yoga programs can actually help significantly lower your blood pressure. Those are good things to be thinking about. So maybe finding a mall, I don't know, Les, that offers those sort of things. In fact, I was just talking with my mother this morning, and she's in a tai chi class now. She's 80 years old, lives in Arizona, and now, you know, she saw these women out on the sidewalk doing these funny movements. She asked them what they were doing, but they told her it was tai chi, and so she's now in a tai chi class as of this morning, so that's great. She doesn't have high blood pressure, but I'm sure it'll be good for her. And then we're going to talk about supplements in a little bit, but coenzyme Q10 and omega-3 fatty acids are both supplements that have some good research showing effects on lowering blood pressure. A few comments about inflammation. We know that I just wanted to talk about blood pressure for one other thing. You've heard me primarily probably, but probably Pam a little bit too, preach about the dangers of soda consumption, and unfortunately, as I quote or put on a slide here recently in a presentation for the Future Masters, we have an enormous consumption. I think it's the equivalent of 612-ounce sodas per year per person in the United States at this point. So almost 2 12-ounce sodas a day per person, which is quite remarkable. Since I don't drink any sodas a day, there's somebody out there who's drinking even more sodas as a result of that. This is a study that was just published recently. It wasn't published yet. It actually was presented at the American Stroke Association's International Stroke Conference just last week. And it basically showed a correlation between diet soda consumption and vascular events, with some of the theory being because a lot of the diet sodas are fairly high in sodium content, and so the more diet sodas that you consume, so we clearly know the calorie content of regular sodas is something you want to try and stay away from, just empty calories that are absolutely leading, you know, helping to the obesity epidemic, as well as the phosphoric acid in sodas contributing to demineralization of your teeth and bones, potentially. We now have another reason to not drink sodas, even diet sodas, with increasing the odds of having a vascular event, in particular a stroke. Okay, a few comments about inflammation. Kind of as Les has said, a lot of this is going to be educational and going to be things that you've heard before, but again, this is archived so that you have people that are coming in and want to learn more about heart disease and what they can do. This will be all good information. So inflammation is a relatively new risk factor. So when I was going through medical school, we won't talk about how long ago that was, but it was more than 10 years ago, certainly. And it's really been just in the last, not even 10 years, probably 7 to 8 years, that we've been correlating inflammation as a risk factor. We identified cholesterol as a risk factor probably about 30 to 35 years ago. We now know that you need to have inflammation first, inflammation in the arterial walls that is damaging the lining of the arterial walls that allows the cholesterol then to kind of adhere onto those arterial walls, leading to that atherosclerotic buildup. So inflammation is in some ways a good thing. We've talked about this when we talk about immunity. Inflammation is part of the normal immune response to injury or to infection. But chronic low-grade inflammation is not a good thing and definitely leads to all sorts of health risks, including heart disease. We now have identified a marker for chronic low-grade inflammation in the body. There's all sorts of different markers that are being looked at related in the laboratory setting and in the research setting. But in the clinical setting and talking to your doctors about knowing whether you have a tendency or you have existing low-grade inflammation, systemic inflammation in your body, the marker is C-reactive protein. You've, of course, heard us talk about that related to the landmark study. That was one of the biomarkers that we looked at. And so we now know definitely that that the highly specific or heart-specific C-reactive protein is definitely a marker that does correlate with an increased risk of heart disease. So what are the numbers that you want to be concerned about, that you want to be looking for? I think one of the other things that we really want to stress in providing education for people is to be proactive about asking about these things and discussing these things with your physician, and also to know what your numbers are, because you can have a better feel and a better control if you actually know what your numbers are, so that you can know if you're making progress, whether it's your blood pressure, your cholesterol, your C-reactive protein level. So if your C-reactive protein level is lower than 1 milligram per liter, then you have a low risk of heart disease. If you're between 1 and 3 milligrams per liter, then you're at an average risk for heart disease. And if you're above 3 milligrams per liter, then that person is at high risk, actually, for heart disease. There are other reasons why someone may have an elevated C-reactive protein, and that is cancer and autoimmune disorders. Things that lead to this low-grade inflammation include smoking, clearly, hypertension, elevated lipids, and hyperglycemia. So again, diabetes, high blood pressure, elevated lipids, all the things we've been talking about, also lead to inflammation, which is another risk factor now for the development of heart disease. So what can you do about that? Obviously, all the things we've been talking about, addressing cholesterol, blood pressure, lipids, et cetera. Okay, so let's now turn to particular supplements that may, again, provide value if you're wanting to be educated about and be proactive about heart health. I'm going to turn that back over to Les to talk about omega-3 fatty acids and sterols and stanols.
Okay, great. Omega-3 fatty acids, we know about them. They're essential, necessary for human health, but the body can't make them, so you need to get them from food. Omega-3 fatty acids are primarily found in fish, including fatty fish like salmon, tuna, but also other seafood, including algae and krill, some plants, and nut oils as well. Although also known as polyunsaturated fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids play a crucial role in brain function as well as normal growth and development. They become very popular because of their potential benefits on heart health and for reducing the risk of heart disease. And in fact, there's an FDA-approved claim for reducing the risk of heart disease with consumption of omega-3 fatty acids. The American Heart Association recommends eating fish, particularly fatty fish, like you would find in a nice sushi restaurant, at least 2 times per week. And when you do that, if you're eating fatty fish a couple of times a week, your intake of omega-3 fatty acids potentially is going to be somewhere around 250 to about 500 milligrams, maybe a little bit more than that per day. Research shows that omega-3 fatty acids reduces inflammation, very important as Dr. Jamie mentioned, and may help lower risk of chronic diseases like heart disease, cancer, and arthritis. They're highly concentrated in the brain and appear to be really important for cognitive function and behavioral function and brain performance as well. In fact, infants who don't get enough omega-3 fatty acids from mothers during pregnancy are at risk for developing vision, nerve, and other problems. American Heart Association, again, in addition to the eating fish 2 times a week for those healthy individuals without pre-existing heart disease, they further make recommendations for those with existing heart health conditions. They recommend 1 to 4 grams EPA plus DHA per day, preferably from fatty fish, but dietary supplements are considered in consultation with a physician. And they further recommend a range of 2 to 4 grams of EPA plus DHA per day as capsules under-efficient physicians' care for those who need to lower their triglycerides. An interesting question that comes up sometimes is, what about the benefits of eating fish and shellfish? Are they outweighed by the potential risk of contamination with environmental toxins? And interestingly enough, the dietary guidelines that just came out, the main thinking there is that for most healthy people, most healthy adults, there isn't a risk, and the benefits of eating fish far outweigh the concerns, although women who are pregnant, women who may become pregnant, nursing mothers, and young children are advised to take certain precautions in terms of limits in how much fish and how much of certain types of fish they would consume each day. Obviously, we believe that omega-3 fatty acid supplements offer a safe, high-potency omega-3 fatty acid alternative for those whose fish intakes are not likely to reach optimal levels. Real quickly now, I'm going to talk about sterols and stanols. What are phytosterols? Well, phytosterols, referred to as plant sterol and stanol esters, they're a group of naturally occurring compounds found in plant cell membranes. And the way they work is because phytosterols are structurally similar to cholesterol in the body. When they are consumed, they compete with cholesterol for absorption into the digestive system. And as a result, cholesterol absorption is blocked to some degree, and blood cholesterol levels can be reduced. As part of a heart-healthy eating plan, the Cleveland Clinic suggests that consuming phytosterols in recommended quantities has been shown to lower total cholesterol up to 10% and LDL or bad cholesterol up to 14%. And this reduction is in addition to other cholesterol-lowering strategies. So that's real key. It's in addition to other cholesterol-lowering strategies, such as eating a heart-healthy diet or even taking a cholesterol-lowering drug like a statin. And the effectiveness of phytosterols is so strong that the National Cholesterol Education Program recommends that people with high cholesterol levels consume 2 grams of phytosterols each day. Just 2 additional points I want to make on the phytosterols. There are a couple of very, very good research studies. These are called meta-analyses or reviews of the existing literature out there. The first study is a DeMonte study. This was published in 2009, and basically in a review of over 84 different clinical studies, they found that a mean dose of 2.15 grams of phytosterols resulted in an average 8.8% reduction in LDL cholesterol, very, very significant. The most important determinants of having that positive impact were to have a dosage of greater than 2 grams per day. Wasn't so important what form the dosage came in. It was also very important that the dosage was split in at least 2 times per day, and that's why many make the recommendations that you would take phytosterol products or supplements with or before each of your meals, or certainly each of your heavier meals for maximum benefit. The other study that was published in 2009 in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition was a meta-analysis of 8 studies in which phytosterols were taken in conjunction with statin therapy. And in the conclusion, they say, based upon the current literature, we can only say that plant sterols and stanols, when administered in addition to statins, favorably affect total and LDL cholesterol with 95% confidence. So these are pretty strong support research studies or support research reviews for the incorporation not only of omega-3s but also plant sterols and stanols into your diet for cholesterol-lowering benefit. And now back to Dr. McManus.
Okay. And I'm going to talk just briefly here about coenzyme Q10 and then a little bit about resveratrol and then some new study that just got published that we're really happy to talk about tonight. So coenzyme Q10, just a little bit of information on what it is. It's a compound that is found naturally in the energy-producing center of your cells known as your mitochondria. You've heard us talk about mitochondria a lot. So one of their functions is to produce CoQ10. CoQ10 is involved in making ATP, which is that energy unit that is produced by mitochondria that can decline in production over time. CoQ10 is also independently an antioxidant. So it is obviously part of the energy process, the energy generation process in your cells, so cellular energy production, as well as has a direct antioxidant effect, which means scavenging free radicals, damaging compounds in the body that actually can damage DNA, cell membranes, and lead to things such as aging. So CoQ10 boosts energy, enhances the immune system, and acts as an antioxidant. So there's been a lot of research looking at the effects of coenzyme Q10 supplements, both alone as well as in combination with other drug therapy in a variety of different health conditions. We get a lot of questions about this here. So this is not going to be an extensive review of coenzyme Q10, but just some things that are related to our topic tonight, which is heart disease. So researchers do believe that there's a beneficial effect of coenzyme Q10 in the prevention and treatment of heart disease, probably by its ability to improve energy production in cells, inhibit blood clot formation, and act as an antioxidant. It's really important to know that this is not a substitute. Any of the supplements we're talking about, let me just put the disclaimer in here for all supplements, is that these are not replacements for appropriate diagnosis and treatment by your physician or being followed along by your physician, cardiologist, internist, whoever is following you for your heart disease, should you have heart disease and be under treatment. But clearly there is research out there. There's a lot of research underway in CoQ10. There are still conflicting data, and so, you know, they're basically most of the heart experts at this point, are comfortable with CoQ10 supplements being used as part of a heart health support regimen. The data over the last few years has been a little bit conflicting related to heart failure. So whereas 5 years ago it was a more accepted part of the regimen for treatment, part of the, alternative kind of complementary integrative approach to treating heart failure, now the latest American Heart Association kind of guidelines actually say that CoQ10 does not actually replace or provide any additional benefit to usual treatment. But you can discuss that with your doctor, your cardiologist. They may have had different experiences. This is an area that is continuing to evolve. So heart disease, yes. Heart failure, some question at this point. There's a number of clinical studies that actually show that coenzyme Q10 may lower blood pressure. So this may be another strategy as one of the risk factors. Again, it may be in part why we see people with heart disease who also oftentimes have high blood pressure, see that coenzyme Q10 may be the mechanism by which heart disease is being reduced in risk. So the Mayo Clinic says taking CoQ10 supplements can correct the deficiency that is caused by statin medication. So this is also has become a much more common common understanding by all cardiologists that the levels of CoQ10 tend to be lower in people with high cholesterol than people with healthy cholesterol. They also seem to be lower even than that if they're taking statin drugs for that high cholesterol. So we now know that most of the statin drugs, the all the ones you know about, Zocor, Mevacor, et cetera, Lipitor, all seem to result in depletions of coenzyme Q10. So taking CoQ10 supplements can correct the deficiency that is caused by statin medications without affecting the medication's effect on lowering cholesterol levels. There's also studies showing that coenzyme Q10 taken along with statin medications can decrease the likelihood of the muscle pains or myalgias that also can occur and may even limit the usage of statin treatment. Some of the other things just to throw out there, again, these are preliminary studies and or, kind of early research, but kind of interesting that, again, I mentioned coenzyme Q10 may improve immune function, and in particular people with immune deficiencies. Some things like AIDS AIDS and people that have chronic infections may actually have an improvement in their immune function with CoQ10. It also may improve sperm motility and enhance fertility, and it's also being used as part of the treatment for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, also possibly because of depletions of coenzyme Q10 that occur normally with age. So we're essentially repleting the declining production of coenzyme Q10 because of mitochondrial declines. There's also some studies showing that people with chronic fatigue syndrome show an increase in energy, again, possibly again related to its effect on mitochondria. So coenzyme Q10, I think, is a very interesting supplement for all of us to be thinking about and using. And then just a few comments. I'm going to throw it back to Les here because we're running a little bit long here. So instead of going into a whole lot of detail on resveratrol, we're going to talk a little bit about resveratrol and polyphenols. Just a few opening comments, and we'll throw it back to you to talk about the exciting news that many of you have been waiting for, that we've been waiting for a while. So resveratrol, again, this is the compound found in grapes, red wine, that has been associated with the potential heart health benefits. The French paradox is basically theory related to why the French, who have very high intakes of saturated fats, but also drink a fair bit of red wine, have significantly lower risks of heart disease than many of their European counterparts, who don't eat as much saturated fat, nor drink as much red wine. And so moderate alcohol consumption has been associated with, and in particular red wine, has been associated with heart health. There's a lot of research on resveratrol, as most of you are aware out there, related to longevity as well as heart benefits. Resveratrol is in a category of compounds called polyphenols that include green tea and things, other grape extracts, things like muscadine. And so we're actually excited to talk about a new study that is quite interesting, talking about postprandial inflammation and oxidative stress, which are things we've been talking about, which we know are known risk factors for the development of heart disease. So, Les.
So we're very pleased to announce the publication of our Shackley-sponsored research, and this was work done up at the State University of New York at Buffalo by Paresh Dandona, Hussam Ghanem, and their group, who has done a lot of work in studying the oxidative and inflammatory stress that accommodates or accompanies a high-fat, high-carbohydrate meal. This was a high-fat, high-calorie fast food meal that's become probably all too typical of some American breakfast, and as there is an acute inflammatory and potentially damaging over the long-term response to such average American eating these days, they have spent the last 10 years looking at different compounds that might alleviate or that might be able to battle or address this response. So the publication was first published online just last week in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The title is A Resveratrol and Polyphenol Preparation Suppresses Oxidative and Inflammatory Stress Response to a High-Fat, High-Carbohydrate Meal. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but I do want to give you some very important highlights, some conclusions that come out of the study, and we'll also obviously making this information available and communicating more about the study and links to the study, because it's online and people will be able to access it, learn more about the study, and share the study with others as well. In terms of background on the study, and I'm taking this right off the study summary and abstract, background: high-fat, high-carbohydrate meals are known to induce oxidative and inflammatory stress. So the hypothesis of this study was that the intake of a nutritional supplement containing resveratrol and muscadine grape polyphenols could reduce the high-fat, high-carbohydrate meal-induced oxidative and inflammatory stress and stimulate the activity of an antioxidant transcription factor called NRF2, sort of a master antioxidant regulator of cell defenses. And that was one of the key targets in this study. The methods: 10 healthy normal subjects were given the very, very high-fat meal with either a placebo or the supplement, and the various indices of oxidative stress and inflammation, including NRF2 binding capacity, were measured. The results were that the intake of a supplement suppress the meal-induced elevations of plasma endotoxins and LBP concentration, et cetera, while enhancing NRF2 binding capacity and the expression of some downstream NRF2 genes. The authors conclude that a supplement containing resveratrol and muscadine polyphenols suppresses the increase in oxidative stress, et cetera, after a high-fat, high-carbohydrate meal. These results demonstrate the acute antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects of resveratrol and polyphenolic compounds in humans in the postprandial state. So very important. Again, very positive results on supplement effect, beneficial effects, positive effects on meal-induced oxidative stress and meal-induced inflammation. And, you know, we're pleased to announce this is one of the first human studies, one of the first human clinical studies done on resveratrol and resveratrol and polyphenol compounds. We think this is going to be a very important contribution to the scientific research and the scientific knowledge base with regards to resveratrol, other polyphenols, and their importance in nutrition and health. So without going into any more about that, again, it's in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. It was first published online just last week. It will actually go into the print edition, I believe, in May of this year, but we'll be sharing more information about this in the coming days.
Okay, so that's very exciting news about the publication of that study, and we'll be getting more information out to you about that in the coming days and weeks. Jody, this concludes the end of part one, so you can end the recording of this section, and we can start now on the new section.